Lead contamination closes a Helena middle school. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us how modern libraries are changing with the times. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Yellowstone National Park official about why they have dropped the idea of bullet vaccinating bison against brucellosis. The state's largest middle school has been abruptly closed after testing found elevated lead levels in the building's basement. Administrators informed parents and teachers at C.R. Anderson Middle School of the closure late last night. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the lead likely comes from the site of the school's old shooting range.
Sean White's son goes to school at C.R. Anderson Middle School in Helena. Well, not for the next week, she realized after seeing the surprise email Monday night.
I was so surprised, I thought it couldn't be true, that it was a hoax, because it seemed incongruous that anyone would post something at 10:15 at night.
The school is closed for lead contamination. So now White and her husband are doing what the rest of the parents of CR's more than 1,000 students are doing.
One person works, the other person stays home, trying to call other families so that your kid can go stay with their kids. It's been a crazy day.
School administrators say the elevated lead levels are showing up in an area of the basement which used to house a school firing range. Helena School Superintendent Kent Colgin says that firing range has been closed for about 20 years, but this is the first time lead testing has been done. He says the results came in late Monday afternoon, and administrators debated on whether or not to wait a day to allow for a smoother closure.
But on the other hand, you think, wow, if we know that those levels are high enough to cause this heightened concern, that we should remove the kids as soon as possible.
Colgin says more intensive testing is now taking place to determine how widespread the lead contamination is. If it's just confined to the basement, then cleanup should take about a week. But if it's more than that, at this point, it's unclear how long it would take. The closure came as a shock to 8th grade English teacher Shannon Pressinger, too.
Because living in Montana, school is never canceled. You know, we can have 6 feet of snow and we don't cancel school.
The school semester was supposed to end this Friday, and her students have been researching a project. Teachers schedule time in the school's computer lab sometimes months in advance.
Some of us won't be able to get back into the lab to do that research and carry that out with the kids.
Pressinger is now busy adjusting her lesson plans. The school will attempt to make up for lost days by lengthening the rest of the year's school days by a few minutes. At least, Pressinger says this whole situation provides a learning experience for students, too.
If we ever learn anything about the key to success is that flexibility is definitely critical.
The school is holding a meeting for parents at Capitol High School Wednesday night at 7 p.m. to provide the results of further testing into the lead contamination. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Helena.
And in other news from around the state, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected a request to review rulings against a Montana law that attempts to exempt guns made and kept in the state from federal regulation. But a separate petition filed by the state attorney general over the Montana Firearms Freedom Act is still pending before the high court. Montana Shooting Sports Association President Gary Marbitz says the court's rejection of his petition yesterday may not bode well for the state's request, but, quote, the fat lady hasn't sung yet, end quote. The 2009 law says firearms that remain in the state where they were manufactured are not subject to Congress's authority to regulate interstate commerce. Two lower courts have ruled against the state law, saying the Supreme Court already has decided the issue in favor of federal regulation. Montana officials are petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court to reverse a lower court's ruling that allows political parties to endorse nonpartisan candidates in Montana's judicial elections. Attorney General Tim Fox and Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell filed the petition yesterday. They are asking the justices to review a Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision that struck down Montana's ban on party endorsements in judicial elections as an unconstitutional violation of free speech. Fox and Modell say the Ninth Circuit's decision ignores constitutional issues that are of, quote, extreme and fundamental importance to the state's sovereign right to decide how judicial elections are held. The Supreme Court rarely accepts petitions to review lower court rulings. There is no timeline for the court to decide whether to take up the Montana case. Commissioners in Ravalli County are asking the State Department of Administration to assess issues with the treasurer's office and provide guidance to the treasurer, who is months behind in processing monthly reports and disbursing tax money. The commissioners held an emergency meeting yesterday where they heard from officials with towns, schools, fire departments, and irrigation districts in the county about the effects of the delays. Stevensville Superintendent Dave Whitesell said payroll is a concern. Treasurer Valerie Stamey reassured commissioners that her office was, quote, literally on the cusp of turning the corner, end quote, and getting issues resolved. Stamey was appointed in September to fill the term of Marie Keaton, who resigned. Since then, the office lost three of its most experienced employees, two of whom questioned Stamey's ability to do the work. Montana's current population of wolves, estimated to be between 600 and 700 wolves, is still a mere fraction of how many wolves once lived in the Big Sky State. Historian Michael Wise says in the mid-19th century, over 1.5 million wolves roamed the northern plains, with hundreds of thousands of them living in Montana. That was also the peak of the bison population, and wolves fed on the thousands of bison carcasses left by hunters who just wanted the bison's fur. When cattle came, Wise says bounties were placed on the wolves, both to keep them from preying on the cattle and to sell the wolf fur to an international market.
You know, most people who I talk to are startled just when they realize, you know, the number of wolves that were killed under the bounty system alone in Montana. 1899 was sort of the climax year for the bounty bills, and over 23,000 wolves were killed in Montana that year alone. In 1870, 1871, one fur company alone in Montana, CC Power Company, which is one of the big four Benton fur trading companies, sold almost 34,000 wolf pelts down the Missouri River over just a couple of years.
Wise has an article on the history of killing wolves in Montana in the winter issue of Montana, the magazine of Western history. News director Sally Mock will have a feature interview with Wise tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition. Montana regulators have approved a Canadian company's plans to expand the Golden Sunlight gold mine near Whitehall. Today's Department of Environmental Quality decision allows Barrick Gold Corporation to expand one pit and open another. New mining will occur on 68 acres and produce almost 53 million tons of waste rock. DEQ officials say the expansion will extend the 200-worker mine's life by 2 years to 2017. The DEQ permit requires that polluted water from mining be captured and treated. It also requires Barrick to prepare a plan to use the wall of the new mine pit for bat and raptor habitat. The company also must put a ground movement monitoring system in place to ensure safe access to the pit when operations cease. An 81-year-old Helena man was cited for misdemeanor arson after strong winds spread a scrap wood fire he started through his wooden fence and onto a neighbor's property. Buddy Mergenthaler tells the Independent Record the wind wasn't blowing at 9 a.m. yesterday when he set fire to the wood scraps in a cast iron bathtub and covered them with the screen. He says he watched it until about 3 p.m. when he went inside to get a snack. Wind spread the fire to the ground, where it burned through part of Mergenthaler's fence, melted a molded plastic storage shed, scorched his neighbor's motorhome, and threatened the neighbor's house. Six fire departments responded. Southwestern Montana was under a high wind warning yesterday, with gusts of up to 60 miles per hour expected. Picture a library, a brick building, rows of books, signs saying shh. Perhaps the word musty comes to mind. Maybe you feel a twinge of guilt remembering that late fee you still haven't paid. But yesterday afternoon at the Kalispell Library, kids were stacking blocks and coloring. People of all ages were having their snapshots taken in a photo booth. There was live music, as well as those rows of books and people accessing the internet. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on why the Flathead Library is making noise and going fine free.
Walking into Flathead County Library's main branch in Kalispell, there's the smell of fresh, buttery popcorn. And Alex Hogel and Jeremy Marone play bluegrass music as people check out books, browse, and snack. There's also a big sign saying, "Imagine If." Librarian April Zutch says Flathead County Libraries are now Imagine If libraries.
Really, it's all about thinking outside what a traditional library has been. Going beyond just books, just sitting down and reading quietly by yourself or having overdue fines. We don't have overdue fines anymore.
There won't be live music and popcorn every day, but there will be projects and opportunities to get messy. For example, next month they're building a chicken coop. Library Director Kim Crowley says getting messy is one way people learn.
So some people learn by doing and by making. Other people learn by checking out a book. And these different activities will allow all of those learning styles to be addressed, and we'll have a lot of fun doing these things too.
Crowley says about a year ago they embarked on this rebranding effort. She says the term itself, library, needed to be rejuvenated.
And we know that people use the library now more than ever. Our numbers are much higher than they've been ever. But some people have this old notion of libraries, that it's just a building that has some musty old books in it. You have to be quiet. So we wanted to refresh that notion.
Zutch says it is a way they're staying relevant in an increasingly digital age, but it's also a way they're reconnecting with the community.
For people who don't use the library, you know, we kind of had to do something big to let them know the library is really different from when you were a kid or when you were in school. And it's already a community gathering place and a place where people bring their kids and they have an outing, and it's, you know, a fun adventure. You never know what you're going to find at the library.
Crowley says they've been reaching out to kids in non-traditional ways for several years. Story Hour still has stories, but also crayons, markers, glue, and scissors for accompanying art projects. Teen groups meet for food, social events, and book talk, too.
Probably the biggest change is that we will have some of these hands-on interactive zones for adults so that they can get their hands dirty, listen to music, eat popcorn.
Crowley says they're doing away with the late fees because they create a barrier for some people to access the library, particularly young people. Plus, the fees made it so that increasingly, librarians were having negative interactions with patrons, collecting fines instead of helping track down a book. She says they still expect books, DVDs, audio recordings, etc., returned on time. If a material is a month overdue, the patron will not be able to check out new items. But she says it was clear to them that late fees didn't work anyway. Otherwise, having items overdue wouldn't be an issue. This week, the Imagine If Libraries of Kalispell, Big Fork, Columbia Falls, and Marion are kicking off the rebranding with different events at the various branches.
Yeah, it's been really positive and has been really busy all day.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely been a much busier Monday than we've seen in quite a while.
Zutch says they hope to have music every month or so. They also have art exhibit space and are taking applications for artists to show their work. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
A Kalispell man has claimed the grand prize of the Montana Millionaire Raffle. Montana lottery officials say Russell Miller purchased his winning ticket at Mike's of Columbia Falls and claimed his winnings today. Miller says he learned he won by checking the numbers in the newspaper 3 days after the drawing. He says he's thought about what he would do if he won more than $5 or $10. He says he plans to donate some of the $1 million grand prize to some organizations that he and his wife have given to in the past. Yellowstone National Park administrators say shooting wild bison with vaccine-laced bio-bullets to prevent the spread of an animal disease would be too ineffective to justify the expense. Today's announcement means a program that's led to the periodic capture and slaughter of thousands of migrating bison will continue. About half of Yellowstone's 4,600 bison test positive for brucellosis, which causes pregnant animals to prematurely abort their young. Edward O'Brien has more with Yellowstone spokesman Al Nash on the history of this remote vaccination concept.
Back in 2000, the National Park Service was part of a group of state and federal agencies that ended up in a court-mediated settlement on a way to manage bison in and around Yellowstone National Park. And this all germinated from that court-mediated decision and the subsequent environmental impact statement.
When we talk about remote vaccination, what does that mean? Remote, in this case, means what?
What we studied was the possibility of injecting wild bison at a distance with some kind of technology rather than trying to provide a brucellosis vaccine by herding up animals and physically injecting them with a syringe.
And why? Does that lower stress on them? Was that the idea?
Our intent, whenever possible, is to treat wild animals as wild animals. So we explored the idea and the existing technology of providing this vaccine to bison with as minimal an impact on the animals as we could.
And I'm assuming that there's no difference in the vaccination itself, just a different delivery method,
I guess.
It
really is a different delivery mechanism. And so the technology that we studied was the idea of putting the vaccine in what's called a biobullet, a biodegradable projectile that could be discharged to reach the animal at a distance using essentially an air rifle.
And the preferred alternative, the decision that was announced today, is a no-action alternative. It seems like the Park Service wasn't that interested in the remote vaccination idea. And obvious question, how come?
When we looked at the existing vaccine and the existing technology and the time and money it would take to have a very small reduction in the prevalence of brucellosis in bison using current mechanisms or anything we see in the short-term future, we just didn't think it was an appropriate action to take.
The investment of time and money, how much additional time would it take? How much money would it take?
You know, we were looking at millions of taxpayer dollars and a 30-year implementation program, and in doing so, we didn't believe that that would show much of a difference in the seroprevalence of bison, and frankly, we didn't see how it would contribute to our conservation of wild bison.
A 30-year implementation, why so long?
Because it would take our study suggests that it would take a lot of time and repeated treatments in order to have any impact. And even at that point, what we determined was it just wouldn't be significant. You know, we promised under the IBMP that we would study this issue. And this is not to say that we're not going to address the issue of brucellosis or the issue that surrounds bison, elk, and cattle. You know, the bottom line is we have, working with our partners, been very effective. We have completely kept wild bison from infecting area livestock with brucellosis. We do some hand syringe injection when the opportunity presents itself at our Stevens Creek facility. And again, our no-action alternative is going to suggest that we're going to continue to do that when the opportunity presents itself. And then, frankly, we're going to continue to work with our partners to look at technological advances to see other ways that we might be able to address this issue in the future.
Other potential ways, including what?
We don't know yet. I mean, the truth is, we studied the technology and the vaccine available, the implementation plan that would result in some small reduction of prevalence we didn't feel was worth the time or the money, but that doesn't mean we aren't going to continue to investigate other opportunities.
And you say the existing hand syringe method will be used when the opportunity presents itself, and that's typically when?
If we have bison leave in significant numbers and find ourselves in a position where we would haze and capture animals, there are some opportunities there to do some selective vaccination of bison with the RB51 vaccine.
Why are we talking just about bison and not vaccination of elk at the same time?
Our charge and our task under the IBMP is to work with our partners to address bison and brucellosis and livestock protection. Remember, our ongoing goal is to protect and conserve the wild bison population and to address the issue of the potential of transmission of brucellosis from wild bison to area livestock. That's not to say that the issue surrounding elk isn't important. That is not what we were specifically charged with trying to address.
Last question, and I guess that's dealing with the efficacy of this vaccine. Just how effective is it?
You know, this vaccine is fairly effective in cattle. It is less effective in bison. And, you know, there are no plans at this point, to my understanding, to develop a new vaccine.
And that goes back perhaps to the technological advances that you talked about earlier.
Right. You know, we're, like I said, we studied what exists and what we expect to exist in the future, and we did not see that this was a wise investment of our time and the taxpayers' money for a very small reduction in seroprevalence in bison over a very long period of time.
Okay, so Superintendent Wenk now has this preferred alternative. Where does he go with it now?
Well, at this point, the superintendent is going to continue to review this material. At some point in the coming weeks, the superintendent will make a recommendation to the regional director of the National Park Service. And it ultimately, the regional director will issue a record of decision based on that recommendation and her review of the situation. We'd expect that decision to come either late in the winter or early in the spring.
Yellowstone National Park spokesman Al Nash, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 18 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect from 11 p.m. this evening to 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front and eastern Glacier County. Tonight should be mostly cloudy, becoming partly cloudy with lows in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour and increasing to 75 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 40s, with wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Al Smith.
The LA Times has an editorial today on a subject I've spoken about before, arbitration. It opens with a what if. What if the LA Dodgers have just won the pennant and are going to play the New York Yankees in the World Series? But the rules have changed. All games will be played in Yankee Stadium, and there are new umpires, hired and paid for by the Yankees. The opening concludes with the observation that with rules like that, the Dodgers wouldn't stand much of a chance. As I've explained before, arbitration is a legal process to resolve disputes between parties without using the court system. Provisions for arbitration are usually contained in a contract between two parties. Those contract provisions set out the rules for the arbitration, including how an arbitrator will be chosen, which of the parties will pay for the arbitration services, and where the arbitration proceeding will take place. Originally enacted in the 1920s, the Federal Arbitration Act was a means to enforce arbitration provisions and contracts between large corporations, parties roughly on equal footing, with the business and legal expertise to knowingly waive the right to take disputes to court. Arbitration isn't just for corporate equals anymore. Arbitration provisions are now so common in consumer contracts, you'll be hard-pressed to find a single consumer, whether they know it or not, who is not subject to a mandatory arbitration clause in a consumer contract. If you have ever purchased or rented a cell phone, a car, a computer, or have a credit card or bank account, you likely have unknowingly waived your right to take a court, a dispute about that product, a service, or a fee, and agreed to mandatory binding arbitration. The U.S. Supreme Court over the last few years has repeatedly declined to void consumer contract arbitration provisions and uphold an individual's right under the Seventh Amendment to have civil disputes decided by a jury. Last year, the court again sided with corporations, leaving consumers with no recourse, prohibiting consumers from using class action arbitration and thereby giving corporations an arbitration-free pass. No accountability unless someone is willing to spend more money than they could ever hope to recover. Denied the ability to join other consumers in a class action, what sane consumer would spend thousands of dollars to regain a bogus $30 fee? Able to collect a bogus $30 fee from tens of thousands of consumers who have no viable recourse, what corporation wouldn't put arbitration provisions in their contracts? Montana's efforts to protect consumers from knowingly waiving their constitutional rights to a civil jury trial through arbitration provisions have been among those rebuked by the U.S. Supreme Court. A Great Falls couple, the Casarados, had a dispute with a national corporation regarding a franchise agreement. When they sought to have their dispute heard in court, the corporation invoked the arbitration clause in the agreement. The Casarados argued that Montana's law required that in order to be valid, notice of arbitration clauses needed to be conspicuous, not merely buried in the fine print of the back pages of a contract. Montana's statutes required that notice of arbitration provisions had to be on the first page of a contract, in capital letters and underlined. Because the required notice was not in the agreement, the Montana Supreme Court voided the arbitration provision and said the Casarados could pursue their dispute in court. Writing for the Montana Supreme Court, Justice Treewater said, quote, "Presumably, therefore, the Supreme Court would not find it a threat to the policies of the Federal Arbitration Act for a state to require that before arbitration agreements are enforceable, they be entered knowingly. To hold otherwise would be to infer that arbitration is so onerous as a means of dispute resolution that it can only be foisted upon the uninformed. That would be inconsistent with the conclusion that the parties to the contract are free to decide how their disputes will be resolved," end quote. Just as Treewater was wrong, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the arbitration provision twice, voiding Montana's protective law. Now, onerous mandatory pre-dispute arbitration clauses can be foisted upon the uninformed and the informed. Consumers are not on equal footing with corporations, and even informed consumers are presented with take-it-or-leave-it contracts. Corporations get to choose who the arbitrator is and where the arbitration takes place, and the cost of arbitration is often impressive. I talked last month about the possibility for some relief from abusive arbitration provisions for consumer contracts. The Consumer Protection Financial Bureau is studying the use of pre-dispute arbitration contract provisions in consumer financial products or services. But for any real relief, we have to look to Congress. U.S. Senator Al Franken and U.S. Representative Hank Johnson have introduced the Arbitration Fairness Act to restore Americans' rights. The AFA would eliminate forced arbitration in employment, consumer, civil rights, and antitrust cases. It would reopen the courthouse doors to millions of Americans, replacing the umpires beholden to the corporations that feed them with the true umpires provided for by our constitutions, juries, and judges. This is Al Smith for the Montana Trial Lawyers.
Al Smith is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.